It's been a great school. Hasn't it been a wonderful school? How many of you are here in this session now and were not in the session one? Okay, so just a few. Okay, so I'll just recap very briefly then. The subject of this course, which is going to continue now and then on into the afternoon, is called Creating a New Mind. And we're looking at the Baha'i writings to see what are the principles involved in creating a new mind. And first we looked at two psychological principles, one from science and one from psychology. And who can tell me what those two principles are? The one from physics is what? It's the concept that you cannot change your opinion of something or your idea of something without changing your frame of reference. The second is that we looked at a particular concept in psychology in which they believe that the human being doesn't have as good perception as we think. And what was that called? Inattentional blindness. And you can look both these things up. They're quite easily referenced on the internet or in textbooks and so on. Then we looked at the fact that Baha'u'llah says there are two worlds. And we started talking about one of the two worlds. Which one? The physical world. And we described some of the qualities of the physical world. And we know that Baha'u'llah says we should only abide in one of those two worlds. Which one? The spiritual world. But for some reason, Baha'u'llah says he shows us the physical world and hides the other one from us. And he hides the one that he wants us to live in and shows us the one he doesn't want us to live in. And he says, the reason for this is a mystery which only the pure in heart can comprehend, and therefore I cannot comprehend it. So I said, well, let's try to figure out what is the physical world, and let's try to figure out what is the spiritual world. What's the MO, so to speak, of each world? And we already found out some of the qualities of the physical world. I can't remember how far we got, but we found that it's not reality. We found it was illusory, or it was an illusion. We found it was valueless and insignificant. In fact, it was not even as valuable as the black eye of a dead aunt, okay, or a dead uncle, I understand the same. And did we get to vain or fleeting? I think we got to fleeting, and then we stopped. Okay, so let's move right along to fleeting. Now, the interesting thing about fleeting is that he says that fleeting is something you should meditate on. There's some things that Baha'u'llah tells you to meditate on. Have you noticed that? He says something, he says, meditate on this. And we should really take him at his word, because some things, when you meditate on them, lots of things are revealed. There are many passages in which Baha'u'llah or Adabaha says, this is a brief answer, but if you meditate, the rest will be given to you. And this is because he knows the human faculty has the ability to reflect truth. And if he gives you enough of it, you can find the rest. Well, one of those things is the fleetingness of this world. He says, meditate on it. He says, wert thou to consider this world and realize how fleeting are the things that pertain unto it, thou wouldst choose to tread no path except the path of service to the cause of thy Lord. Now, you know as well as I do that if you're not going to stay somewhere for very long, you don't have as much regard for it. Isn't that right? Like, for example, if you have to buy a house and live in it for the rest of your life, you're going to want to have it comfortable. But if you want to stay somewhere for just a night, you know, you can say, it's just a night, I can sleep there. Is that right? So basically, your knowledge of how long something is going to last can determine how you treat it. For example, if someone is standing up here giving a talk, for one person, you might say, well, if he's going to speak for 5 minutes, I'll sit here. But any longer than that, I'm not. You see, it determines how you view something. And Baha'u'llah says you need to think about how fleeting the world is so you don't regard it with any great value. He says, your lives on this earthly plane, which pass away as a fleeting moment. They pass away as a fleeting moment. He says, whosoever hath tasted the sweetness of these worlds will never consent to transgress the bounds which God has fixed. He will turn his gaze towards no one except the well-beloved. Such a man will, with his inner eye, readily recognize how altogether vain and fleeting are the things of this world, and will set his affections on things above. How vain and fleeting. In some prayers, we pray to God to give us the frame of reference that the world is fleeting. We actually pray for a frame of reference. It doesn't say that way. It doesn't say, oh God, give me a frame of reference that the world is fleeting. But it says basically that. For example, he says, give me to drink of the wine of thy mercy and of the pure beverage of thy favor, which have streamed forth from the right hand of thy will, that I may so fix my gaze upon thee and be so detached from all else but thee, that the world and all that hath been created therein may appear before me as a fleeting day, which thou hast not deigned to create. So you pray to God to give you the vision that the world is just a fleeting day. There's another prayer here I could read in which he says, O God, give me a disposition that will enable me to consider the world as a shadow that vanisheth swifter than the twinkling of an eye. We're actually praying for God to give us a new frame of reference. And that frame of reference is that we're just here for a very brief period of time. So fleeting is fairly... Okay, well, look at this. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. I had fun with fleeting. Okay. The next thing, I not even mentioned this, but the next quality of the physical world is that it is constrained by certain limitations that are artificial. The physical world is constrained by certain limitations that are artificial. And some of these limitations are time and physical space, or physical matter and physical space, time and space. Now, this is a very important thing to understand, that time is part of the physical world and is not part of the spiritual world. In fact, the spiritual world is more often referred to in terms of eternalness than it is in terms of placeless. Like he says, the placeless, but he more often says the eternal realm, the immortal realm, eternity, and so on. Timeless and so on. In other words, it's quite easy for most of us to somewhat imagine a world without physical matter. We can kind of vaguely... I can imagine that there's a world in which I'm just a ghost like Casper flying around. It's kind of, I can roughly get a feel of that. It's much more difficult for me to get the concept of there being no time. That's a greater limitation than the other. And the concept of eternity, Adibaha says, is one of the great concepts to meditate. He says, if you want to acquire spirituality, meditate on the future life. If you meditate on eternity, you gain a completely new frame of reference. And eternity is a very large subject. Now, I don't know how to pronounce the word in Arabic very well. But is it Baqa or Baq? How do you say it? Baqa? Okay, Baqa. And this is a very important concept, and it's all over the Baha'i writings, translated variously by different words. And it means eternity. In Sufi mysticism and in Islamic tradition generally, there are two fundamental states that are the highest. They are Fana and Baha. Do we have Mr. Fana here? Is he here? Yes. He's named after Fana. But Fana and Baha are the two great states in Sufi mysticism. Fana is the last valley in the seven valleys. It's one word, but in seven valleys they translate it as, what is it, absolute nothingness and true poverty. It takes a lot of English words to contain that. And after you reach Fana, which means complete annihilation of a self, you go to eternity. And eternity is such an important concept because if we meditate on God's eternity, we come to some realization about the reality of the other world. Now, there is one prayer that uses this word eternity 60 times in one prayer, the long healing prayer. And it has the Baqa 60 times. I think we counted it more than 60 times in it. In English, it's translated as abiding, but it's abiding in the sense of the eternal nature of God. Shoghi Effendi translated that word in various forms. So we have this thing about eternity, and the important thing to understand about eternity is that some people think eternity is endless time. It's just time going on and on and on. We think eternity is endless time. For example, we think, how long is this speech going to last? It's going to last an eternity. Now, eternity is not endless time. Eternity is no time. It's not endless time. It's no time. There's a big difference. And in the Seven Valleys, Baha'u'llah explains that there are three kinds of eternity. He says there's four kinds of time. Does anyone remember the word zaman? Who knows the four? Anyone know them? It doesn't matter. There's four kinds of time. Three of them refer to aspects of eternity, and one refers to this kind of time that has a beginning and end in this world. And he says the one kind of eternity has no beginning, but it has some end. So it goes that way and has an end. Another has a beginning, but it has no end. And the third has no beginning and no end. And it's very important to meditate on all three of these. And so just think of a hose that has a stop here and goes forever that way, or when it goes that way, and so on. And I was very glad to read this in the Seven Valleys one time, because I used to think that Baha'u'llah was redundant in the first hidden word. Because he said, if you have a pure, kindly, and radiant heart, you'll have a sovereignty ancient, imperishable, and everlasting. And I thought, well, you know, why do you have to say all three? You know, can't you just, you said that the hidden words were going to be in the garment of brevity. Why did you say three things that mean the same thing? And then when I read that Baha'u'llah said that eternity is classified into three areas, I thought very carefully, well, ancient gives an indication of backwardness forever, but doesn't guarantee that it couldn't die sometime. Imperishable, it goes that way, but it doesn't give any guarantee it could have been created yesterday. And everlasting goes both ways. So Baha'u'llah was very careful to say that you have all forms of eternity. And he defined them. And I will bet you, although I haven't, maybe a Persian or an Arab, someone speaks Arabic, I'll bet you they're the same words in the Seven Valleys as in the first hidden word. I'll bet you they're the same. So the concept of eternity is very, very important. Don't think of eternity as a line going that way forever. Just think of it as an instant beam going up, like Scotty would beam you up, or something like that. Eternity is no time. So the physical world is limited by time. Fortunately, I say fortunately, I'm not sure, modern physics, at least since, 1905 or thereabouts, has figured out that time is pretty phony anyway. We thought time was some kind of constant in the universe. In fact, there was time, and then there was space, and space had three dimensions, and time was one dimension. And Einstein comes along, and he meditates, and he gets a new frame of reference, and he somehow realizes that time is totally phony. It can slow down. It can speed up. It doesn't really slow down or speed up according to your experience of it, but relative to someone else. So if I'm standing on the sun, if I could stand on the sun, like I could go at night, like the old joke is, time moves much slower for me. Time moves slower for me on the sun because gravity slows down time. In fact, even time on Earth, right here where we are, moves 7 milliseconds slower than the satellite that's just in space that your cell phone uses, just because it's a little closer to Earth. Gravity slows time down. The more gravity you have, the slower time has. And if you have a lot of gravity, like a black hole, you have virtually eternity. And if you bring all the universe into one dot, which they call the singularity, which means that one time before the Big Bang, everything, they say it had to have been eternity. And so if you imagine that God is all creation and he has all gravity, then you could say, veiled in my immemorial being and the ancient eternity of my essence. If God is all things, he would bring all time into it. Also, many people like to compare gravity to love. How many of you have heard of that? That gravity is kind of like love? Well, Einstein found that the stronger the gravitational field, the slower time comes down. And Abdu'l-Bahá said, where there's love, there is always time. Now, I don't know. It's just a very interesting concept, you see? So we have to free ourselves from the concept of time. It is the greatest of all the limitations of the physical world. It's a much greater barrier to our thinking. Now, there are many things about eternity that I can't talk about. We would have to give a whole talk just on eternity. Why are you laughing now? What's so funny?
How long have you been talking about?
Well, yes. It would take me a long time to talk about eternity. That's a very good, I like that. So let's move on to another principle of the physical world, and that is that the physical world is a symbolic representation of this world. Okay, now we dealt with this subject last year, so I don't want to talk about it too much, but basically Abdu'l-Bahá said, if you want to understand the spiritual world, look to the physical world. Look to the physical world and you'll understand it. And any time the manifestation of God uses a physical symbol to represent a spiritual truth, you should think hard and long about that physical symbol, because a lot of spiritual truth will be given to you. Now, all religions in the past have relied on this principle, that the physical world represents the spiritual world. And Advaita said there would be no way in which the manifestations could teach anything if they didn't have the physical world as an example. And this is why God created the physical world as a mirror, because the physical world is like the language of the spiritual world. That's why it's called the kingdom of names. A name doesn't have reality. It represents something. And this world doesn't have reality, but it represents something, just like a word represents a concept or an idea. Religions in the past are traditionally divided into various classifications. So they call them pantheism, polytheism, monotheism, and there's one other great one, idolatry. Okay, these are the various, you know, anthropologists, they look and they say, and religions, some they're idol worships, and some they're pantheistic, and some they're polytheistic, and some are monotheistic from Abraham on. It's my belief that probably all religions were true and divine, and they weren't polytheistic or pantheistic or whatever. It's just that the symbols were used, and now in history we lost it. So a long time ago, to teach the concept of the manifestation of God, they may had to use the sun, or they may had to use the stars or heaven or water and rivers, things that gave life that they could understand in the physical world. With the passage of time and the loss of language, we look at these religions and we say they were sun worshippers, or they worshipped, you know, the heavens or the stars, or they worshipped rivers and called them sacred. But I don't believe that. I believe that these were symbols that they used, and they perfectly well understood that they were talking about God, but that was a way to explain it. Likewise, God has many attributes, and Advaita says there is no way to know the reality or essence of God. You can only know his names or attributes. Consequently, God is often described in different ways. This characteristic, that characteristic, this characteristic. And so in some cultures, those become personified. So as in the Indian cultures or the Greek cultures. And then we think they're polytheistic, but they weren't polytheistic. You could look at the long healing prayer and say that's polytheistic because it's calling on 140 different gods. But we understand it's one God with 140 attributes. Likewise, pantheism, which is the belief that God actually is in physical matter, like he's in the trees and he's in the thing. Advaita says there basically is a foundational truth to pantheism, that in one sense, pantheism is correct. So my belief is that all religions were true and divine, and only because we don't have a good knowledge or record of this, we don't realize that they had a good understanding that this physical world symbolically represented the spiritual world, and that's the only way the manifestation of God can do it. Now, last year, I proposed the idea that we know more about the physical world today than we've ever known before. Consequently, we have more ability to understand spiritual truth, because in the past, they only knew sun and river and ocean. There was only so much language the manifestation of God could use to educate us about spiritual things. And lo and behold, Advaita writes a letter to the Baha'is in America about Rezvan, and he says, in this century, more scientific achievements and discoveries have been made than in the past 100 centuries. Now, I read that last year, but it didn't hit me what Advaita was saying. Because what is 100 centuries? Is it not 10,000 years? Okay, 10,000 years is more than what we call recorded history. Okay, recorded history, 7,000 years is not very much. And Advaita is saying that there has been more scientific discoveries this century than take the invention of the wheel, the discovery of fire, and take everything that the Greeks discovered and everything that Newton and Galileo and all the Arabian Islamic, add it all together, and it still doesn't equal what we've learned in this one century? I didn't believe it. I didn't believe it myself. So I went to several textbooks that listed every scientific discovery, like the 1,000 greatest discoveries or the 100 greatest discoveries of physics or biology, and I just looked at the dates of all of them and then calculated it, and I found to my startling belief, even when you throw in Newton and Galileo and Plato and Aristotle and who you name it, the majority of everything we know about everything, any branch of science, the majority has been discovered during the time since the Bab and Baha'u'llah appeared. Isn't that amazing? The majority of everything we know. You can test this yourself. Go to the internet and do some research. It'll take you a long time, but you'll come to the conclusion that Adivaha was right, which probably we probably should have just accepted to begin with. But so this means that the physical world, although it is valueless, it's insignificant, it's fleeting, it's illusory, it still has the power to communicate something to us if we use it as a language of the spiritual world. The final principle of the physical world, and we're going to get onto the spiritual world soon, is that Adivaha said the time here on this life is latent with opportunity. The time we spend here has a lot of opportunity. For example, he says, the fleeting hours of man's life on earth pass swiftly by, and the little that still remaineth shall come to an end. But that which endureth and lasteth forevermore is the fruit that man reapeth from his servitude at the divine threshold. Behold the truth of this saying, how abundant and glorious are the proofs therein in the world of being. And in answer to one question, he once said that the value of this life is very much like a man going on a journey through many countries. He says, when you go on a journey through many countries, you gain different perspectives and understandings of cultures and different things. He basically could have said frame of reference as well there. So there is something about this world that has opportunity. The Sufi mystics who always taught by parable, which is another way of using the physical world, they understood the physical world, the opportunity of the physical world, in a famous story about a camel rider in the desert. And this was that a man who wanted to ride a camel through a long journey in the desert. He gets on the camel and he starts to ride through the desert. And after many days' journey, a voice cries out and says, stop and gather up the stones in the dried up riverbed. And he looks down and there's a little riverbed there, dried up. And this voice says, stop and gather the stones in the dried up riverbed. So he gets off the camel, he picks up a handful of stones and puts them in his saddlebag, and he gets on the camel, and the voice cries out again and says, good, because you have obeyed, tomorrow you will be both happy and sad. And he says, I'll be happy and sad? I don't quite understand that. So he rides off, rides into the sunset, goes to sleep, wakes up the next morning, and he remembers the strange events of the previous day. He goes back to his saddlebag, reaches inside, and all those stones were now gems. They were precious jewels. And at that very moment, he was happy that he had gathered all those stones, but sad that he hadn't taken more. Because the river was full of stones. It was completely full of stones. And he could have taken as much as he wanted to. And this is what the hand of the cause, John Robarts, always said. This life is like a bird flying through a banquet hall. The table is full. It just can fly in. It can grab something on the table and go out. And it has to fly out the other side. And then you realize, oh my God, there was some really good food on that table that you could no longer take. So this is the last concept of the physical world. Now, the thing about it is, the physical world, it very much draws our attention. The physical world is counting the cars, and the spiritual world is the gorilla. Now, if you weren't in the talk earlier today and you just heard that I said the physical world is counting cars and the spiritual world is the gorilla, I'm sorry, I'm not going to explain it to you, but everyone else understands what we're talking about. You may not realize this, that the horse, you know, the animal, the horse, is one of a certain group of animals that has rear vision. Did you know that a horse has rear vision? And the reason is because of the location of its eyes and the shape of its head. And so it can flip and it can look pretty much back, or it can just go like that and it can see. Because of this characteristic of the horse is naturally very good at racing. In the wild, horses, you know, they race because they can see the horse coming from behind and they can decide when to make their move. They're naturally well built for racing because they have total rear vision. It's like they have a rear vision, a side vision, and forward vision, all with just two eyes. Because of this, when man started to race horses, when he first started to race horses, I don't know how many hundreds or thousands of years ago, he found that the horse was making too many decisions about racing. The horse knew too much, and the jockey wanted to have total control of the horse, and I want to decide when you move and when you don't move. So they built blinders to put on horses, and they go like this, And they basically cut off 3/4 of the horse's vision, just so the jockey can completely have control of the horse. And it seems like such torture. And go look at one of these blinders and you'll realize what a torture it is, cutting off 3/4 of their vision. But if you think about it, we all have blinders on ourselves too. And it's this physical world that puts the blinders on us. And consequently, we are being ridden like a jockey towards a certain finish line that the physical world defines for us, and never realizing that the physical world puts blinders on us in the same way that we put blinders on a horse. What are some of the blinders of the physical world? Well, I could probably name dozens and dozens of them. One of them is material wealth. Wouldn't you believe that that's a blinder? Another one is the desire for physical comfort. That's a blinder. Another is the desire for material possessions. These are blinders that cause us not to see things. Another is the worship of the physical body or the desire for physical beauty. And that even more decadent concept, the worship of youth in our culture, in which for some reason we value a young body over an old body. Or even worse, we think we're worthless as we get older, as if the physical body matters. And Baha'u'llah talks about many other things that are, you would classify as blinders. One is he calls idle fancies and vain imaginations. In other words, any idea that you just pick up by osmosis in the world, that you never really gave it some thought and it's not true. These are all blinders. Now, we could probably do a whole talk on blinders. The whole idea of the advancement over others or being better than others, these are all blinders. We are taught from the day we're born until the day we're dead by this physical world that these are important things. And if you want to get to the finish line of the physical life, like a horse, you've got to not see all these things. We need to take the blinders off. We need to take them off because this is not the horse race of life that we're meant to run. It is the phony one. Now, it's so phony that it makes me think that God is playing hanky-panky. Now, the reason I use the word hanky-panky, and you're laughing right now, is because some of you may not realize the meaning of that word or the origin of that phrase. In fact, the word hanky-panky was common in England in the 17th, 18th, 19th centuries among magicians. And it was a magician term because magicians found that if you wanted to do a trick, any trick at all, with one hand, all you had to do is at the certain moment, with one hand, the other hand, you would pull a handkerchief out. And you'd fluff it out, and it would be a brightly colored handkerchief. And you'd pull that out, and then at that moment, you would do the thing that you needed to pull a coin out of the pocket, or, you know, do whatever it is. And any magician knew that if a handkerchief came out, look anywhere but the handkerchief. They understood that. But the normal person didn't understand. And this worked so well that magicians did it over and over again. Anytime they wanted to do any trick, out came the handkerchief. And after a while, they said, it's the old hanky-panky. And that's where the phrase comes. Now, hanky-panky is nothing but an expression of inattentional blindness. Isn't that right? If you look at one thing, you miss the other. But it worked so well that it became a catchphrase. It became a phrase. And when Baha'u'llah says, blind thine eye, or close one eye and look at the other, he also understands inattentional blindness. So is God not playing hanky-panky when he says, I've created one world, I'm showing you one, hiding the other? Is he not, in the true meaning of the word? Now don't go home and say, Tom says God plays hanky-panky. Okay? unless you explain the origin of the meaning of the word. But you can see that inattentional blindness definitely applies to the spiritual world. You don't see the gorilla because the physical world is making you count the cars. Does that make sense? It's a very simple concept. So, do you think we have a good idea what this world is like? Fleeting, inconsequential, restricted by time, and so on. How about the qualities of this other world? This is the world we really want to know. So I wrote down some, I went to the writings and I looked at quotations, and this is not every one, but I was classifying them in various categories, and these are some of the ones that I want to mention today. One of the qualities of the real world is that it is multi-sensual. Multisensual means it has a number of different senses. And we'll come to that in a moment. The second principle is that it is very close to us and very quickly reached. Close and quickly reached. The third, it is not bound by time and space, which is actually just the opposite of the other one. The fourth is that in order to live in it, you have to acquire what Adibaha calls the fourth kind of spirit, or the fourth kind of life form. There are five kinds of spirit or life, and in order to go into that world, you have to have a different kind of life than the one you have in this world, and we'll talk about that. And the fifth is that in order to dwell in the rose garden of the spirit, which is where room 40, what room was it number now? If you want to dwell in 47B, it requires a certain measure of withdrawal from the physical world, a certain amount of physical sensory deprivation. When I say a certain amount, not total, but it does require a certain amount, and that amount we're going to try and define. So let's look at these five qualities. Now, some of them may surprise you. You may not even know what I meant when I said them. Let's take, first of all, multisensual, the fact that the spiritual world is multisensual. Adibaha says that in the physical world, we have five senses. And in the spiritual world, we also have five senses. Now, maybe or he calls them five powers or five senses. And he describes what the physical senses are and what the spiritual senses are. Now, if you think of the physical senses, the most important thing is that each one does something that the other one cannot do. They don't intersect in capability. Would you agree? Okay, so the eyes can see, the ears can hear, but the ears can't see, and the eyes can't hear, and so on. The nose smells, and the eye doesn't smell. The feet smell, but the eyes don't, and so on. You understand? All of the physical senses don't intersect. Now, there's a very important principle here, because if you use a particular physical sense for something that it's not appropriate, you just don't know anything about that. So, for example, if I were to take a rose and hold it to my ear, I don't get much, right? If I said, you're like a rose to my ears, okay, it doesn't. But if I said, you're like music to my nose, that also doesn't make sense. We understand that there's certain parts of the world that we're just not going to know even exist without that sense or that sense or that sense. If we don't use all of our senses, the loss of any one physical sense will take away a whole chunk of this physical world. Would you agree? You must use them all. So now Adibaha says you've got five spiritual powers as well. And likewise, if we don't use each of those five spiritual powers, we're going to miss on a whole big chunk of that world, because they don't intersect. Let's say I have a chocolate sundae in front of me right now, and I look at it. Let's say it's the best. Have you ever had a really good one? Like, you know, so, and you look at that chocolate sundae. Now, how long could I look at it, and would I understand it as well as if I tasted it? Can the eyes really ever know? Okay, what if I held it up to my ear? It's not going to help at all. Because it's only if you taste the chocolate sundae do you even remotely know. Now, Baha'u'llah says, cause me to taste, O my Lord, the divine sweetness of thy remembrance and praise. If you don't use that spiritual sense, you're going to miss out on God. If you don't use that sense, you're going to miss out on God in whatever he's talking about. Now, if you go through the Baha'i writings and you look at the way in which he refers to understanding God or knowledge, he employs all five of the physical senses. Sometimes he says, cause me to taste of the divine sweetness, cause me to inhale the fragrance, cause me to see. Do you understand? To touch. And every time he's using these, you know that they're spiritual vision. You know that they're spiritual hearing. They're not physical. And yet he uses all. In fact, I went through and collected these, and I found that Baha'u'llah is a completely equal opportunity employer of all five senses in the spiritual world. He uses them all. Now, this is very interesting, because in past religions, to symbolize lack of spiritual perception, they always used an illness that had the lack of a physical sense. So in the Bible, the three things that are most commonly used to represent lack of spiritual knowledge are blindness, which is the lack of the sense of sight, or the lack of the sense of hearing, and so deafness, rather, lack of the sense of, or leprosy, which is the basic symptom of which is the lack of the sense of touch. It's the lack of one of the senses. That's the primary symptom. And we know that when Christ is talking about the leper, he's not talking about the physical leper. He's talking about someone that has one sense missing in the spiritual world. In this case, the sense of touch. He's talking about blindness. He's not talking about physical blindness, but he's talking about the loss of the spiritual power of vision and so on. So the soul has five different powers. And Abdu'l-Bahá describes what they are, and I want you to make a note of what they are, because I'm going to describe them to you now. They're in some answered questions, but we'll go through them. The first spiritual power, he says, is the power of imagination. He refers to this as the first one. That man has the ability to somehow, just in his own mind, see something without his eyes seeing. He can envisage things. He can imagine something. This is so fundamentally inherent in the human being and so lacking in animals that it is considered one of the primary characteristics that distinguish human beings. And we're going to talk about that a little later. But Abdu'l-Bahá says it's a spiritual power. It's one of the spiritual senses, imagination. The second one, he says, is reflection. And it's a different power. He sometimes refers to it as thought. But he says it's the power of reflection, that you can actually reflect on something. And once again, this is one of the different characteristics of the soul, and it's different to imagination in the same way that sight is different to hearing. The third power, he says, is comprehension. He uses some other terms, but comprehension, in which you understand something. It comes third in Abdu'l-Bahá's list. The fourth he calls memory, and some other terms, and I like to think of memory as like hitting the save button on the computer. You know, you hit the save and then you got it stored, you know where it is, and so on. And the fifth sense is an interesting one. He refers to it as the common faculty, and he says this is a spiritual power that has the ability to communicate with the physical. It's like the messenger boy of the spirit. Because the physical and the spiritual have to communicate. But the physical can't go that way, but the spiritual can come this way. And that is a special faculty, a special power which the soul has, which he calls the common faculty. There's a letter that Abdu'l-Bahá wrote to I can't remember the doctor now, but he referred to the same thing as the sympathetic nerve. But if you read the wording of how he describes sympathetic nerve, it's quite clear that the sympathetic nerve and the common faculty are one and the same. It's a spiritual power that has the ability to communicate with the physical body. Now, we need to use all of these spiritual powers, and we don't use them. And that's why we don't see a lot of the gorilla of the spiritual world. We're like blind or deaf, and we're not using them. We're even taught in our schools and education to pretty much bypass the first two spiritual powers. Because if you think about it, you first should use imagination, then use reflection, and then go to comprehension. But many times we want to comprehend immediately. We want to bypass the first two, and we want to skip it and go straight to comprehension. We'll read a quotation and we'll say, what does this mean? Or we'll read anything in the newspaper. We want to know what it means now. I want it now. So we want to go straight to comprehension. And yet many times in the writings, Baha'u'llah says, meditate, ponder on this. He says, use your first two spiritual senses. Teachers in school will often insist that a student have immediate comprehension. They'll say something and they say, okay, what does this mean? The student that raises the hand the quickest, he's taught that skip the first two spiritual senses and go straight to comprehension. Then what makes it even worse is our education process says, let's even skip comprehension and go straight to memory. Let's not imagine and do it. Let's not reflect upon it. Let's not even understand it. Just commit it to memory. And students are often taught to do this, and we often do this too. And so then it's like we have no eyes and no ears and no mouth, And it's like if I came up to you right now and said, I want you to open your mouth and eat this, but close your eyes and close your ears and don't smell it, just eat it. And that's basically what you're doing when you don't use these senses. So the spiritual world is multisensual, and we need to know how to use each of these spiritual senses. Now, some of them, Adi Baha has told you how we can use them. For example, he's told us certain rules about how you can use the power of reflection, for example. He says that reflection cannot work unless there's absolute silence. He says this in it's in Paris Talks, a talk on meditation. I'm going to read from it later on. He says that silence is absolutely necessary for that particular spiritual sense. Now, this is pretty bad, because some of us have no silence in our lives. We wake up in the morning and there might be, you know, noise going on, people in the house or something. We'll go to work, we'll go to school, we'll drive, we'll come back, we'll come home, and we may not have even a moment's silence. And now Adi Baha says this particular sense doesn't work except in silence, just this particular one. So we may have to modify our whole lifestyle to understand how to use some of these senses. Anyway, that's one quality of the spiritual world, that it has many different senses. The second is that it is close and it's quickly reached. Now, this is something kind of interesting, because didn't we just say that it's hard to see, it's the gorilla that you can't see, you're looking at this. Didn't Baha'u'llah say he's hidden it from you and shown you the other? But then he also says, although I've hidden it from you, it's really close. It's very, very close. And also, it's not far away in terms of reaching. You can reach it very quickly. Let me read you some of these quotations. He says in the hidden words, "Thou art but one step away from the glorious heights above and from the celestial tree of love. Take thou one pace and with the next advance into the immortal realm and enter the pavilion of eternity." Now, he says, just take one pace and with the next. And what are you going to enter? Is he referring to the next world as placeless or timeless? I'll read it to you. Advance into the immortal realm and enter the pavilion of eternity. Timeless. Okay? More often, he refers to it as timeless. But you're only one step away. He says in the gleanings, he says, "This most great, this fathomless and surging ocean is near, astonishingly near unto you. Behold, it is closer to you than your life vein. Swift as the twinkling of an eye, you can, if you but wish it, reach and partake of this imperishable favor, this God-given grace, this incorruptible gift, this most potent and unspeakably glorious bounty." And there's many, many quotes. He talks about the divine elixir that can, in the twinkling of an eye, transform you. So, although it's hard to see, it's kind of like the gorilla that we can't see, nevertheless, it's very close, and it can be quickly reached. The next one is about, it is not bound by space and time. But we've already talked about the converse of that, so I'm going to move on. The next feature of this world over here, we're going to call it the Rose Garden of the Spirit. You want to call it that from now on? Because that's in the first hidden word. He refers to the Rose Garden of Spirit. And the reason I like to use that is that Adi Baha uses the term spirit to refer to five kinds of life. Five kinds of life, life forms. Don't confuse this with the five kingdoms, which is the mineral kingdom. You know those kingdoms? Okay, or however, how many kingdoms are there? There's four kingdoms. But there's five, what he calls, classifications of spirit. You'll find it on page 144 of Some Answered Questions, but I'm not going to read all of it, because most of them are easily understandable. The first form of spirit, or life form, he says, is vegetable. And it's the first form of life. And you have to agree that a vegetable has life. It has the power of growth. You know when it's dead or alive, and it is the first form of spirit. The second, he says, is the animal spirit. And there's no question that the animal has many more capabilities than the plant. It has the physical senses, it can travel, it can do things. It's a major step up from the vegetable. He says the third is man. And he goes on for a long time to explain how different man is from the animal. And although materialistic viewpoints now don't see as much difference in man as the animal as Adabaha does, it's quite obvious that there are many things that man can do. His powers of thought, imagination, symbolism, language, overcoming his environment, all of these things, the animal doesn't even have 1% of these things. So it's quite clear that there is a huge jump from animal to man. So now we got 1, 2, and 3. Would you agree? Number 1 is vegetable or plant, and then number 2 is animal and man. I'm going to skip number 4 for a moment and go straight to 5. And 5 is the Holy Spirit. And that's pretty obvious that that gets its own life form, wouldn't you agree? And he says the Holy Spirit is the emanation like the rays of the sun from God. And if you read it very carefully, it's the manifestation of God, or it's the form of God that we can recognize being the manifestation. And that's the fifth life form. So we got 3 out of 4. But this fourth one is the weird one. And he says, he describes it in various terms. One of them, he says, it's the spirit of faith. But that's not a complete definition. He says, it is the this, it is the that, it is the spirit of faith. So now I'm saying, wait a moment, faith gets its own whole life form? You know, you got animal, mineral, vegetable, and faith? I thought faith was just an attribute, like joy or patience or something. You know, patience says gets mad. How come you get your own life form? You know, how come faith gets its own life form? And yet Adabaha says that faith is a new form of life. And it's the only form of life that can dwell in that world. Just like the physical man can only dwell in this world, the animal part of man, this other life can dwell in that rose garden of the spirit. That's why it's called the rose garden of the spirit, because the spirit is a new form of life. Now, this is obviously what Christ meant when he said that if you have faith, you're born again. Clearly, that's what he meant. It's the same thing that Adabaha was saying, that there is a new life created when you have faith. Now, the funny thing is that Adabaha says that without this life form of faith, without it, we can't achieve anything. He says the human spirit, unless assisted by the spirit of faith, does not become acquainted with the divine secrets and the heavenly realities. So this is a serious matter. We want to dwell in the rose garden of the spirit. He says without this new life form, faith, you cannot become acquainted with the divine secrets. Now, one might say, well, can't I just live a good life? Can't I just have virtues? Can't I do all the good things and not have faith? And of course, we read this in Baha'u'llah says, you know, that there's twin duties. One is recognition and faith and manifestation, and one is observance of his laws. That faith is an absolutely essential quality to understand the spiritual world. But you still say, Adabaha, why do I need to have faith? And so he answers that question in a very interesting way. He says that the mirror, although clear and polished, has no power unto itself unless you take it out into the sun. You can have a perfectly shined mirror and put it in a darkened room, and it, however clean it shines, it has no capability, because it must go out in the sun. I'm going to read this. He says, the human spirit, unless assisted by the spirit of faith, does not become acquainted with the divine secrets and the heavenly realities. It is like a mirror, which, although clear and polished and brilliant, is still in need of light. Until a ray of sun reflects upon it, it cannot discover the heavenly secrets. So I quickly said, okay, so basically what Adabaha is saying is that faith is like a mirror. A mirror is a two-way process, or the action of a mirror, because something comes into it and it reflects back out. We normally think of faith as a one-way thing. And Adabaha redefines faith as being a two-way process. Now, I was so pleased when I realized that the fourth life form is symbolized by Adabaha by a mirror. I was very pleased by it because I was very, very upset with my research at this point, because there were two hidden words, and they both said that you must do something first. And it so happens that the first Arabic hidden word says his first counsel is to possess a pure heart. And I'm very mechanistic in my thinking, okay, that's the first thing you got to do. And then the first Persian hidden word says the first thing you got to do is dwell in the rose garden of the Spirit. And I'm saying, make up your mind, Baha'u'llah. What is the first thing I'm supposed to do? Then suddenly, I read from Abdu'l-Bahá that the spirit of faith is like a mirror. And because of the way in which I conduct my research, any time a symbol comes up, I think, what are the essential qualities of that symbol? The first thing we should always do when the writings use a symbol is, what are the essential qualities? And so you think carefully, what are the essential qualities of a mirror? And you say, well, a mirror requires two things. It requires two things. It must be unobstructed and clean and pure, and it must be taken out into something in the light. And either one without the other, the mirror can't function. So there are two things. There are two things you must do first. Do you understand? A mirror that's perfectly polished and pure, but in a darkened room, has no power at all. But a mirror that has dust and dirt and dross and everything, you take it out, also has no power to reflect. You need to do both. Consequently, the first two hidden words are telling you the two things you must do. If there was never a mirror that you saw, and you never had a mirror in your life, and you bought one, and it came with a user's manual, surely the user's manual would say, step one, make sure it's unobstructed and clean, and take it and face it something in the light. It would say those two things first. That would be. Now, the human soul also comes with a user's manual, and it's called the hidden words. And the hidden words says the first thing you need to do is have a pure heart and take it out into the rose garden of the Spirit. And by doing that, it gives birth to a completely new life form, as different as the animal is to the plant or man is to the animal. It's a new life form that's given birth, and it's the power of reflection. So now I challenge you to go home and look in ocean and type the word mirror in there and see how many times the analogy of mirror is used to refer to men. And if we had a whole day, we could just read over and over again. And he says everything in creation is a mirror to a certain extent. Some things are more of a mirror than others. But of course, we couldn't see anything if it didn't have some reflection. So everything is, he says, everything is a mirror of God, but man is a perfect mirror. Man is potentially a perfect mirror. A manifestation of God is a perfect mirror. Man has potentialities. And if you think of all the things that God uses to symbolize man in physical creation, man or life is usually symbolized by water or metallic things or gems. Gems are used to symbolize virtue, and gems are highly reflective. They're mirrors of exactly one color. And we're told that a gem is a virtue, and a virtue is a reflection of one attribute of God. Okay, we're told that man is very much like metal, like gold or silver, and it's highly reflective. Water is a symbol for life, and it's highly reflective as well. Many of the highest, most beautiful symbols in the writings are also mirrors. But we can't go into that too much. So basically, think of faith as a two-way process. And you have to now go to your dictionary and look up the word faith and cross out the definition. Okay, you just need to cross it out. Because some of us think faith is something that has no consciousness, that has no life. In fact, we say, oh, just accept it on faith, or blind faith. And in one place, Abdu'l-Bahá says faith is conscious knowledge. It's a different word. Just don't even use it. That's why I like to say use the fourth life form. I want to have a new word so that we don't obstruct our thinking by language, because we're going to have to rewrite the language. The definition of faith has to be there. Okay, so now we're going to move on to the last aspect of the spiritual world. And that is that to dwell in the spiritual world, it requires a certain measure of withdrawal from the physical world, a certain amount of sensory deprivation. Now, this is a really important subject. And how much time do I have before we take a break? We have 5 minutes, and then we have a 15-minute break? Okay. So then I'm going to move on into this, even though I won't be able to finish it. Baha'u'llah says that you have to not look at the physical world or not partake of it to a certain extent. I'll read a few of these. O son of dust, blind thine eyes that thou mayest behold my beauty. Stop thine ears that thou mayest hearken unto the sweet melody of my voice. empty thyself of all learning, that thou mayest partake of my knowledge, and sanctify thyself from riches, that thou mayest obtain a lasting share from the ocean of my eternal wealth. Blind thine eyes, that is, to all save my beauty. Stop thine ears to all save my word. Empty thyself of all learning save the knowledge of me, that with a clear vision, a pure heart, and an attentive ear, thou mayest enter the court of my holiness. So he's saying certain things, your eyes, your ears, your knowledge, you have to stop them to a certain extent so that you can have these other things. Now, he says, close one eye and open the other. Close one to the world and all that is therein, and open the other to the hallowed beauty of the Beloved. He says, wouldst thou have me, seek none other than me, and wouldst thou gaze upon my beauty, close thine eyes to the world and all that is therein. For my will and the will of an other than me, even as fire and water cannot dwell together in one heart. Now, this is very interesting. You can't see one thing if you're looking at the other. And so you have to stop looking at the other. Remember in the inattentional blindness that it is not hard to see the gorilla. And you don't try to see the gorilla. All you have to do is stop counting the cars. And then suddenly, what's that gorilla doing there? Okay, isn't that interesting? And so Baha'u'llah doesn't say, try and see the spiritual world. He says, stop looking at the physical world. Because he knows if you do that, you will see it. So this means that there is some amount of sensory deprivation required. And when I say sensory deprivation, we too much please and satisfy our five senses. We overload them, and our five senses send signals through what we call the nerves into the brain, and the brain is full of it, and we're constantly bombarding. We bombard our senses in every way. And if we do this more than a certain amount, Baha'u'llah says, then we can't see the spiritual world. Now, he says that the best way to understand this is to meditate on what he calls the most mysterious of the signs of God amongst men. He says you need to meditate on what he calls the most mysterious of the signs of God amongst men. What is the most mysterious of the signs of God amongst men? I think of all the signs of God that there are amongst men, and one of them, Baha'u'llah says, is the most mysterious of them all. And what do you think that is? And he says, if we meditate upon this particular thing, we will understand some of the concepts which I want to talk about sensory deprivation. Who can possibly guess what Baha'u'llah was referring to when he said the most mysterious signs of God amongst men? Who wants to? The soul? Okay, correct. He says it's dreams. He says, thy state when you're asleep. He says, consider thy state when asleep. Verily I say, this phenomenon is the most mysterious of the signs of God amongst men, were they to ponder it in their hearts. And then he goes on to explain all the things about dreams. In fact, in the Seven Valleys, he said there is a myriad mysteries that can be revealed in the state of dreaming. Let me read a little bit of that, and we'll continue after the break. One of the created phenomena is the dream. Behold how many secrets are deposited therein, how many wisdoms treasured up, how many worlds concealed. Observe how thou art asleep in a dwelling, and its doors are barred. On a sudden thou findest thyself in a far-off city, which thou enterest without moving thy feet or wearying thy body. Without using thine eyes thou seest, without taxing thine ears thou hearest, without a tongue thou speakest. So first of all, it's quite obvious that we don't need the physical senses to see, to hear, to taste, to touch, and so on. That there is a world that can exist. So clearly dreams are proof of the existence of the other world, but that is only scratching the surface of what Baha'u'llah wants to get to. He then also says, perchance, when 10 years are gone, thou wilt witness in the outer world the very things thou hast dreamed tonight. And so he basically explains that dreams are free of physical space, they're free of all physical matter, and even of time, they transcend. Now, that's not even close, because now there are many wisdoms to ponder in the dreams, which none but the people of this valley, this is the Seven Valleys, can comprehend in their true elements. First, what is this world, where without eye and ear and hand and tongue, man puts all of these to use? Second, how is it that in the outer world thou seest the effect of a dream when it hadn't happened yet? I'm not going to read it on. Now, I want to explain to you some startling scientific knowledge about the physiology of dreaming. Because Baha'u'llah said to meditate and ponder on this mystery. And so the first thing we should do is see what science, and particularly in the 1960s and 70s, when a lot of dream research happened, we know a whole lot about the physiology of dreaming, and it gives you tremendous spiritual insight into the most mysterious phenomena. So I will go immediately into that after we have a 15-minute break right now. Thank you. You've been very attentive. I really appreciate it.